It's time for justice. Welcome to the Central Virginia Legal Aid Radio Show, heard every Wednesday from 12:30 to 1 p.m. on 97.3 WRIR and at www.wrir.org. I'm your host, Marty Wegebright. This show is written and produced by Central Virginia Legal Aid Society. We give free, civil, non-criminal legal aid to low-income people in Richmond, Petersburg, Charlottesville, and surrounding cities and counties. Coming up on this week's show...
If we want to know why some low-income families live with lead paint and exposed wires and broken windows, things that are terrible for kids' health, one reason is they're forced to accept those conditions in the harried aftermath of an eviction.
Associate Professor Matthew Desmond talks about his New York Times best-selling book, Evicted, Poverty and Profit in the American City, and why it is impossible to consider poverty in America without tackling the central role of housing. And during this week's News You Can Use, we explain why the mental health coverage gap remains, despite lawmakers' efforts and assertions. All that and more coming up. Stay with us. The show is supported in part by a grant from the Virginia Law Foundation. This show, number 290, is the sole responsibility of Central Virginia Legal Aid Society and gives only general legal information. If you have a legal problem and need specific legal advice about your situation, contact an attorney. If you can't afford an attorney, we'll tell you later in the show how to get free legal advice or representation in a civil case. The Central Virginia Legal Aid Radio Show is heard every Wednesday at 12:30 on WRIR 97.3 FM, Richmond Independent Radio, and online at www.wrir.org, and is made possible by community radio volunteers at WRIR. And now, this week's News You Can Use. State lawmakers haven't gone as far as they should, or as far as some claimed, in the effort to help more people with serious mental illness get the help they need. Starting in July, an estimated 3,600 additional Virginians who struggle economically and suffer from serious mental illness will be able to get some treatment through the Governor's Access Program. By devoting an additional $5.4 million with an equal federal match, lawmakers increased the eligibility level in this program for a single person to approximately $10,000, up from roughly $7,700 a year. The legislature's stated commitment to treatment for mental illness was captured well in this quote from Speaker Howell's communications director. Quote, the House of Delegates has worked closely with Governor McAuliffe on the Governor's Access Program, which provides mental health services to those making less than 100% of the federal poverty level. Instead of expanding Medicaid, the House has made this plan a priority. End of quote. The trouble is, the new higher eligibility level that the General Assembly actually enacted in the law only goes up to 80% of the federal poverty line, not 100%. By only expanding coverage for mental health services to 80% of the federal poverty line, lawmakers continue to leave people out in the cold. And by refusing to expand Medicaid, state lawmakers rejected a common-sense move that would have provided comprehensive medical coverage, including mental health treatment, for many more low-income, uninsured Virginians and saved the state money. Had lawmakers actually made the Governor's Access Program a priority, they would have ensured that all low-income people suffering from serious mental illness could get the medications they need. Fully raising eligibility to 100% of the poverty line would have also meant that the new threshold would be closer to $12,000 per year, matching the minimum income needed to qualify for tax credits to purchase comprehensive coverage in the health insurance marketplace. Instead, there continues to be a situation where even people who barely manage to make ends meet can make too much money to qualify for the Governor's Access Plan and too little money to qualify for marketplace coverage. So, they're still stuck in the gap. No one suffering from a serious mental illness should be denied the care they need, and without this care, people are left to struggle without a realistic shot at managing their disease. With this week's News You Can Use, this is your host, Marty Wegebright. It is impossible to consider poverty in America without tackling the central role of housing. Matthew Desmond, Associate Professor of Social Science at Harvard University and a 2015 MacArthur Fellow, recently gave a webinar on his New York Times best-selling book, Evicted, Poverty and Profit in the American City, described by the Washington Post as an extraordinary feat of reporting and ethnography. The Central Virginia Legal Aid radio show gave a listen, and here is the first part of his remarks.
So America's weird. It's the richest democracy with the worst poverty. And there's no other rich democracy that has the depth of the poverty that we have and the extent of the poverty that we have. And that's something that's always troubled me. It's always something that I found totally unnecessary. And I wanted to understand the role that housing plays in that story. And I thought eviction was a really good window into that or insight into that problem. And so I started this work the old-fashioned way. I moved into a trailer park on the south side of Milwaukee, Wisconsin. I lived in that trailer for about 5 months. And then I moved to the north side of Milwaukee, which is the inner city, and I rented a room in a rooming house, and I lived there for about 10 months. And from those two neighborhoods, I met families getting evicted and followed them everywhere. I went to eviction court with them. I followed them into shelters and abandoned homes. I went to Texas to Iowa with another family. I watched their kids. I ate from their dinner table. I slept on their floor. I went to AA meetings and church and funerals with them and was even there for a birth. But I knew that to really fully understand this kind of story, I needed to understand landlords' perspectives too. So if you were getting evicted, I'm going to get just as close with your landlord doing the evicting as I did with you. So I did. So I went to eviction court with landlords too, and I saw them buy and sell properties, watched them pass out eviction notices, understood like what makes them tick, what ticks them off, why would you buy property in some of our worst neighborhoods, and kind of tried to understand this very old, complicated, and fraught relationship that's so central to the poverty story in America today, that between landlords and tenants. Now, as I was going along with this work, there were all these questions that started kind of appearing that I needed answers to, like how often does eviction happen? Who does it happen to? What are the long-term consequences of getting evicted? And the more these questions kind of kept me up at night, the more I went looking for data or studies that would allow me to answer them, and just came up empty. And this room is very different, but I think folks that were working on poverty problems had spent a lot of time focused on public housing, and they've spent a lot of time looking into neighborhoods. But here was the private rental market, where the vast majority of poor folks lived, and I was seeing play an amazing, huge, imposing role in the families that I was spending time with. It was consuming most of their income, dictating where they lived, who they lived with. We didn't know anything about it. And so I started off doing some things to collect some bigger data on these questions. One thing I did was design a survey over 1,000 renters in the city of Milwaukee. We sent interviewers into people's homes to talk to tenants, to ask them questions about eviction, their children, residential instability, jobs. And we've talked to folks from all over the city in very nice neighborhoods, those are the blue dots, and some really distressed neighborhoods, those are the red dots. One interviewer was mugged, another was bitten by a dog. It was the same interviewer, actually. Needs to work on a situational awareness. But we worked really hard for these data, and we got a very high response rate, 84%. And, you know, we took that, and we were learning a lot of new stuff about the causes and the consequences of eviction. And what I was learning during my field work was deeply informing those questions, not only what we asked, but how we asked it. I didn't stop there. Analyzed hundreds of thousands of eviction records. We talked to 250 people in eviction court right after their hearing. Analyzed millions of 911 calls, hundreds of nuisance ordinances, and put all that big data together in a conversation with the fieldwork. And I think each piece of that study kind of pushed off and challenged the other, and each kept the other honest. But Evicted is a book that really starts on the ground and ends on the ground. It follows 8 families, some are white, some are black, some have kids, some don't, swept up in the process of eviction. So we meet Lorraine, who is my neighbor at the trailer park, who had to decide between paying her rent for this trailer or paying her heat. We meet Lamar, who's this kind of amazingly gregarious single dad trying to raise 2 boys in the inner city. His home was like that home that all the boys go to after school, and he fell behind in his rent. And this W amputee, this wheelchair-bound man, tried to work it off with the landlord, and it didn't work out for him. We meet Vanetta, who was this single mom of 3 kids. This is a woman who worked at Old Country Buffet. And when her hours got cut, she was so terrified of losing her home and maybe her kids that she committed an armed robbery to try to stay in the home. This was someone that had no criminal record. I don't have time to tell you this morning about all these amazing people and their complex stories, but I do want to share one story with you, and that's Arlene's story. So Arlene had a 14-year-old, Jory, and one day he was cutting up like 14-year-olds do, who's throwing snowballs at passing cars, and he packed a really tight one. He just smacked this car, and it jerked to a stop, and this man jumped out. And Jory and his cousin ran inside, and they locked the door, and the man followed them and kicked the door in. And thank God he left before anything else happened. But when Arlene's landlord found out about that, she decided to evict Arlene and her boys for damaging property. And Arlene cussed at Jory because she couldn't cuss the landlord. So Arlene took her two boys, Jory and Jafaris, who was six at the time, to the Salvation Army homeless shelter, which everyone in Milwaukee just calls the Lodge, so you can tell your kids we're staying at the Lodge tonight, like it's a hotel. And from there, they were on the hunt for another place to live. And they found a place on 19th Street. There was often no water, and Jory had a bucket out was in the toilet. It was quiet, Arlene remembered, and 525 for a whole house was my favorite place. When we looked at the survey data, one thing that we found is that families relocate to much worse housing after their eviction. If we want to know why some low-income families live with lead paint and exposed wires and broken windows, things that are terrible for kids' health, one reason is they're forced to accept those conditions in the harried aftermath of an eviction. So the city eventually found Arlene's favorite place. This is at unfit for human habitation. And men boarded up the windows and the doors, and Arlene was on the hunt for another place to live. We take whatever we can get, she told Jory. And that's what, like, housing and neighborhood selection looks like at the very bottom, just taking whatever you could get. And what Arlene could get was a drab apartment complex on Atkinson Avenue. But she soon learned it was a haven for drug dealers. And the whole block was really drug-soaked. It was hot. And she feared for her boys, especially for Jory, who was goofy and had this beautiful smile and would talk to anyone. So in Arlene's case, why she moved, the fact that she was evicted, is really important to understanding why she ended up in such a bad neighborhood. And that's something you can test statistically, too. And we did. And we found that, all else equal, families that get evicted relocate from poor neighborhoods to even poorer ones. They move from dangerous neighborhoods to neighborhoods with even higher levels of crime. So Arlene moved out of Atkinson Avenue as fast as she could. She found a two-bedroom, bottom-unit duplex on 13th Street. There was a fifth-size hole in the living room window, and the carpet was, like, filthy and grounded to the floor. The door had to be locked with, like, this plank you slid into brackets. But Arlene put on a good face. She hung curtains, and she stuffed a piece of cloth into the window. The rent for that place, which is located in a very poor neighborhood in America's fourth poorest city, was $550, utilities not included. That took 88% of Arlene's welfare check. And she knew that some months she'd have to sell her food stamps to get by, and the refrigerator and the pantry would be empty in the 20s and the 30s of the month, and her boys would try to get by on oodles and noodles. Under those conditions, there's no extra money for, like, anything. No clothes or books for Joy or toys for Jafaris. So Jafaris had this amazing ability to transform, like, a leash or a broken mop handle or a bucket into, like, soldiers and tanks locked in battle. So, as this room well knows, Arlene is not alone in spending the vast majority of her income on housing. For almost a century, there's been a broad consensus in America that we should spend 30% of our income on housing. That gives us enough money for food and transportation, put a little away for savings. And for a long time, most renters in the country met that goal. But times have changed, to the point that today, the majority of poor renting families in America spend at least half of their income on housing, and at least one in four spend over 70% just on rent and utility. So, like, first of the month, poof, 70% of your income is gone if you want a roof over your head and hot water. Under those conditions, you don't need, like, a major dislocation or a setback to invite an eviction. Something as innocent as a snowball can do it. For people like Arlene, eviction is much more the result of inevitability than personal irresponsibility.
You've been listening to Matthew Desmond, Associate Professor of Social Science at Harvard University and a 2015 MacArthur Fellow, presenting a webinar on his New York Times best-selling book, Evicted, Poverty and Profit in the American City. We'll be back in a moment. We continue now with the remarks of Matthew Desmond, Associate Professor of Social Science at Harvard University and a 2015 MacArthur Fellow, on his New York Times best-selling book, Evicted, Poverty and Profit in the American City.
So what's happened? So there's three ingredients to this problem. Over the last 20 years, but especially in the 2000s, housing costs all across the country shot up. This is a story about rent, and it's also a story about utilities. According to some estimates, between 1995 and today, median rent in this country increased by over 70%. During the time where low-income families were seeing their housing costs soar, their incomes were remaining flat. So you had some folks around the country that just saw low or no income gains. Some folks had seen falling incomes in real moments. And as you guys know, during the years where more and more families were in need of help to pay basic housing costs, fewer and fewer of those families were receiving it. Nationwide, only about 1 in 4 families that qualifies for housing assistance receives anything. The rest get turned away. That situation would be unthinkable with other kind of basic needs. Imagine if we turn away 3 in 4 families that apply for food stamps. I'm sorry, you have to go hungry. We don't have enough for you. But that's exactly how we treat low-income families seeking shelter. Arlene gave up looking for housing assistance a long time ago, but one day on a whim, she stopped by the housing authority and asked about the list. And she was told by the person behind the glass, the list is frozen, because on it were over 3,500 families who had applied for rent assistance 5 years ago. Could be way worse. Like, the waiting list for public housing in this city is not counted in years. It's counted in decades. So a young parent that applies for public housing in Washington, D.C. is probably a grandparent by the time her or his application comes up for review. So if Arlene wanted public housing, this is what she'd have to do. She'd have to wait 4 or 5 years until the list unfroze, and then she'd have to wait another 4 or 5 years until her name made it to the top of the pile, and then she'd just have to, like, pray that the person reviewing her application would ignore all the evictions she'd collected while trying to make ends meet unassisted in the private market on a welfare check. So on 13th Street, Arlene found a bucket of paint and brushes and rollers in the basement, and she gave the walls a fresh coat. But not long after moving in, her sister died. It wasn't her biological sister, it was her sister in the spiritual sense. They were close. And Arlene contributed some money to the funeral. She didn't have the money, but no one else did either, and she felt it was her duty, her obligation to pitch in. The next month, she missed an appointment with her welfare caseworker because the letter announcing the appointment was mailed to 19th Street, or maybe Atkinson Avenue. So 2 months behind, Arlene got the pink papers, as we call it in Milwaukee, the eviction summons and complaint. So Milwaukee's a city of about 105,000 renter households. Every year in Milwaukee, landlords evict 16,000 people. It's about 40 people a day evicted in Milwaukee. With 1 in 14 renter households evicted every year, forced displacement's frankly commonplace in the inner city. Milwaukee's no outlier. We've now crunched the numbers in Kansas City, in Cleveland, in Chicago. New York City sees 60 Marshall evictions every single day. The latest American Housing Survey data shows that renters in over 2.8 million homes think they'll be evicted soon. So the numbers up on the screen, they only report formal court-ordered evictions. But there are other ways, cheaper and quicker ways, for a landlord to get you out of the house. So I met Joe Porzinski, who's a building manager in the inner city. And what he does is he says, look, Diane, you're behind. If you're out by Sunday, I'll give you $200 and you could use my van if you move. If you got to get evicted, you want that eviction. It's a pretty good eviction. I met a landlord that if you're behind, he'll just take your door off. I met a landlord that if you're behind, he'll short-circuit the electricity and report the city on himself. There are 101 ways to evict a family. We worked really, really hard in the survey to capture all those informal evictions that never see the inside of a court. And if you add those with the formal evictions, and you also account landlord foreclosures and building condemnations, you learn that every 2 years in Milwaukee, 1 in 8 renters is evicted. 1 in 8. Half of those are informal evictions. Eviction affects the old and the young, the sick and the able-bodied, but the face of America's eviction epidemic is moms with kids. Moms with kids. And as many of you know from being in urban housing courts around the country, if you go into eviction court, you just see a ton of kids. Until recently, the South Bronx Housing Court had a daycare inside of it because there were so many kids coming through its doors. And poor African-American women, and mothers in particular, are evicted at startlingly high rates. In Milwaukee, among renters, 1 in 5 black women reports being evicted sometime in her life, compared to 1 in 15 white women. This is like the feminine equivalent to incarceration. We know that many of our young, poor African-American men are being locked up. Many of our poor African-American women are being locked out. But this is not a problem that's just in low-income communities of color. This affects white communities, immigrant communities. It affects expensive cities like D.C. and Boston. It also affects cities like Milwaukee and Houston and St. Louis. Today, one in five of all renting families in America report spending at least half of their income on housing costs. It's a huge, widespread problem. I tell a room that already knows. So in eviction court, this is court custom in Milwaukee, the commissioner gave Arlene 2 extra days for each of her 2 kids. And those days came and went, and she had to be out in a day in early January. Milwaukee's cold in January. And this January was especially cold. The weathermen had been working themselves up. They said it could drop 40 below with the wind chill. There was a frostbite warning that kept flashing across the news screen. But if Arlene waited any longer, the sheriff would come at least 10 days later with a gun and a judge's order and a team of movers, and they would have piled everything on the sidewalk. Everything, like the food, the shower curtain, the mattresses, Jafar's asthma machine. So they struck out into the cold, and it was freezing. It's like that kind of cold that like burns you. And Jory loaded this U-Haul moving truck that a family friend had rented for them. And he smiled through it. He was happy to be helping his mom. So Arlene didn't know where she would spend the night that night. She had tried the lodge and other shelters, but they were full as usual. For now, she was focused on taking what she could to a storage unit that she had sold half of her food stamps and a space heater to rent. So she finally found a shelter 30 minutes away from Milwaukee and was once again on the hunt for another place to live. So she called on or applied for 20 apartments, and then 40, and then 60, and then 80. I counted. She was accepted to none of them. Even in the inner city, many were out of reach, and the landlords of the places she could afford, if she threw basically all she had at the rent, they weren't calling back either. And part of the reason, besides her poverty, was her eviction record. So in Milwaukee and many other cities across the country, thanks to open record laws, your eviction is free. It's online for anyone to see. Most landlords that I met reject anyone with an eviction in the past 2 to 3 years. This is one of the mechanisms, a big mechanism, that explains why families are pushed into worse housing and in worse neighborhoods after their eviction. So finally, the 90th landlord, Mr. 90, said yes. He had a one-bedroom apartment. It was 525. Arlene didn't much consider the condition of the place or the kind of neighborhood it was in. A house is a house, she told Jory. So 2 months after her eviction court hearing, they moved in. And Arlene liked it. Like, all the cabinets had handles, all the lights had fixtures. And when her and her kids had moved some of the stuff up to their apartment, Arlene just, like, sat on the floor. And she found a trash bag with towels in it and just leaned against it. And Jory came and sat next to his mom and pitched his head into her shoulder. And Jafar's came over and laid his little 6-year-old head on her lap. And they just stayed like that for a long time. So Arlene got her stuff out of storage. She hung pictures on the wall. She liked things neat, so she hung a little sign over the sink to Jory that said, "If you don't clean up after yourself, we're going to have problems." So it's tough to be 14. It's tough to be 14 and experience long stretches of homelessness. Between 7th and 8th grade, Jory went to 5 different schools. And at his new school, he started acting out a bit. And one day his teacher yelled at him, and he kicked her in the shin and ran home. And instead of calling the principal, the teacher called the police. And after officers paid Arlene a visit, her landlord told her she had to leave.
You've been listening to Matthew Desmond, Associate Professor of Social Science at Harvard University and a 2015 MacArthur Fellow, presenting a webinar on his New York Times best-selling book, Evicted, Poverty and Profit in the American City. We continue next Wednesday at 12:30 p.m. with the second part of his remarks. This is the Central Virginia Legal Aid Radio Show. That's all for this week's Central Virginia Legal Aid Radio Show. This show is heard every Wednesday from 12:30 to 1 p.m. The show is the sole responsibility of Central Virginia Legal Aid Society. To see if you can get free civil legal aid, call during intake hours. These are Monday through Thursday, 9 a.m. to 11:30 a.m. and 1 p.m. to 2:30 p.m. The phone number is 200-6046 for intake, 648-1012 for the main number, and 1-800-868-1012 to call toll-free. If you have any comments on the show, you can email them to marty@cvlas.org. In addition, every first-run Central Virginia Legal Aid radio show ever broadcast is available at www.radioforall.net. That's radio, the numeral 4, all.net. Then click the contributor link, then click Marty Wegebright, Central Virginia Legal Aid Society. This show provides only general legal information. If you have a legal problem and need specific legal advice about your situation, contact an attorney. If you can't afford one, call Central Virginia Legal Aid Society. It is impossible to consider poverty in America without tackling the central role of housing. Join us next Wednesday at 12:30 p.m. when we broadcast the second part of a special presentation by Associate Professor Matthew Desmond on his New York Times best-selling book, Evicted: Poverty and Profit in the American City. That's law for the rest of us next week on the Central Virginia Legal Aid Radio Show. I'm Marty Wegebright. My Lord.